When one thinks of child narrators in literature, Scout in Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird comes to mind. Well, John C. Hamsey has created a coming-of-age memoir, Kaufman's Hill, told through the eyes and sensibilities of the young John, and in it, creates a character as compelling and unforgettable.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea.
I spoke with Hamsey on the telephone recently, and I'll bring you that conversation shortly. Later in the broadcast, I'll talk with Michael Nagler, who has devoted his life to the study and practice of nonviolence. So please stay with us for the hour.
It's a novel idea.
John C. Hamsey is professor of Romantic and Classical Literature at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, California. And his previous book is Paranoia and Contentment, a personal essay on Western thought. Hamsey is currently working on a novel, Soda Lake, which is excerpted in a recent issue of the Alaska Quarterly. Referring to an early draft of Hamsey's current work, Kaufman's Hill, Howard Zinn said it was the best book on American boyhood in decades. Let's now listen to our conversation. John C. Hamsey, we are here to talk about your latest released book, which is a memoir, though it is a coming-of-age story that reads like a good novel, actually, but it is your story.
Yeah, and I had some, I think, when early stages of the book, I went back and forth about how I was going to frame it. I knew I wanted everything to be true, but I didn't want to write it in a kind of typical memoir fashion, so I called it an autobiographical novel for a long time. So even though everything's true, it's written in vignettes and in the shape of a novel, I think.
It has the unique voice of this little boy. I mean, I was relating to him as this little boy who is just coming of age and is very reflective about what he sees around him. And in fact, in the form of the book, you use passages are in italics. And I was thinking that this was the maybe almost his unconscious or subconscious thoughts that were to himself more than talking to me, the reader.
Yeah, that was actually Bancroft Press. I had a great editor who first stumbled upon the book named Harrison. That was actually his idea. I was only using it for stream of consciousness, but he said, why don't we use it any time he's thinking more than just kind of superficial thoughts, sort of reflecting on what's going on, and I think he was right on that. I think it works really well. The struggle to stay in that voice and consciousness of the boy is really, more than anything, I think the key dragon at the gate of trying to write the book. My family, I have four siblings who are referred to in the book, and they all said, you know, how do you remember all this? And although it sounds kind of corny, I kind of went back in time and actually, almost like hypnotizing yourself, went back into that boy at that time and tried to see it unfold in front of me. I didn't so much write it or create it as go back and bring that consciousness to life. And I wanted to stay true to that because I thought it would have greater sense of presenticity and power if it could be from his point of view rather than an older man looking back and saying, oh, look, you know, what my boyhood was like. I wanted to go there.
I think it effectively did bring me into the mind of that young boy and into youth in general. And, you know, I don't know, I maybe didn't say the name of the book. It's Kaufman's Hill. And Kaufman's Hill is a location that was maybe a hub of activity that also kind of represents a bygone place because that place in Pittsburgh has been consumed by commerce, buildings, whatever, and no longer exists.
Yeah, Ruth Ozeki, in her, the wonderful environmental novelist, when she wrote the book and was kind enough to give me the endorsement, she called it post-industrial America. But you've hit on the two key things. The two key things for me was I wanted to hit the voice perspective of the boy then, and the other thing is I wanted to capture the early, mid-1960s. That's really what I started after first, is I thought a lot of people had done the 50s, a lot of people had done 68 onward, but I wanted to get the time of my boyhood, and I call it kind of a threshold time or a twilight time. It's after the 1950s, but it's before the full-on counterculture comes on, and it's a time of, you know, the suburbs suddenly spreading out and cities losing their relevance and the freeways that we're so used to being built and the first indoor shopping malls being built and our woods disappearing and all that's happening in that early mid-60s. And Coffin's Hill is sort of a symbol of, you know, the last standing point we have. And actually, the hill's there because this department store was a big chain department store called Coffin's. It had two N's in the spelling of it. And they decided to build one in the suburbs, not just have one downtown. And when they did it, they cut away half the hill to build the department store. And that's how my woods were taken away. And what was left was this half hill that they then sprayed this Crown Vetch on, which they do on highways and stuff, so the hill doesn't erode. And that became the Coffin's Hill of the book. And that's, you know, the name we used for it. We would meet there and climb and go up there. And me with this kind of archetypal Huck Finn character, Taddy Keegan. But the whole reality of Coffin's Hill is because of what is happening in the early and mid-60s. And again, I wanted that to be kind of in the background. There's never a point where the boy is talking about it didactically, like where's our woods and why is are all these changes going on? It's just there happening as the backdrop.
And by using that young boy's voice, he was making observations about what was happening, but didn't have the ability to make a judgment about it, really.
That's very good. That's and I wasn't even probably totally aware of that, Suzanne, and you know, until I kind of got into it. But I don't want him making judgments, and I don't want him to be sentimental. You know, I want the book to be sensitive, and he's recording it. But he doesn't have the judgments that we have later as we look back and say, you know, my God, what the hell's happened, you know?
And it's that same point of view of the young boy that, as with many of us, or maybe all of us, as children, we don't know the effects our lives are going to have on us as adults. And his parents were, you know, his dad. You didn't describe the mother and the father other than through his observations. And I think that, you know, the father, your father, but in the book, it was, well, he was probably depressed and unsatisfied and drank maybe just a little too much or used.
Or a lot.
That the mother, your mother, is portrayed as somebody who probably went along with the father's family structure, but was probably much more sensitive and supportive. Or that was the impression I got from reading that. But
No. Your commentary is validation that's the way I wanted it to be portrayed. I mean, I didn't make it up, but. Yeah, my mother is the positive figure that's holding it together, and you got it right. In the early 60s, you know, nobody really talked about depression. My father, obviously, you know, had clinical depression, but you didn't talk about it. You didn't go see a doctor. That led to, the alcohol. Again, everything was covered up, close the windows, you know, don't tell anybody. And so, you know, we look back, and my father didn't get help for all these things, and that led to him being more and more unhappy in work and then trying these deals as a way of making money, and my mother's there holding it all together. But I will say this, as somebody who's been teaching 38 years now, my father was inscrutable to me. I didn't have a lens through which to understand him because he was depressed and withdrawn and never talked and paced and all this. He was just this mystery. And it wasn't until years later, you know, college and graduate school and studying literature and getting my PhD in teaching that I began to understand him. He died in 75. But probably not to the early 80s. And it was literature that helped me, you know, understand who he was. And that sounds far-fetched, but literature and art can help us understand not just the general past, but personal past. And I really began to see him as a kind of combination of a Willie Loman out of Death of the Salesman and a figure out of Greek tragedy. You know, he had all these wonderful traits, but he had so many weaknesses, and the weaknesses went out. And, you know, a man who had potential to be a wonderful, great person just goes into a slow, gradual decline that, to me, I see it on almost tragic, heroic proportions.
I think your observations, just that you made
right now are spot on. And also, I think as we age, and that's really when we get to know our parents and the effects they've had on our lives, whether mm-hmm. they're still with us or not. And maybe it's unfortunate that that's how it happens, but I know I have found that true in my own life, at least. And I also think when I was reading your book, when I thought about the father, who was your father, but it reminded me of many fathers who were either working in factories or involved. I mean, this was a time of post-World War II, post-Korean War,
yes.
and
yes.
that there were lots of men, fathers, walking around with some form of PTSD or depression. And so that was the background for many of us, really.
And women, you know, the wives, were not working. And they kind of kept things going and kept it together. But, I mean, the book, there's several images. Again, it's from a boy's perspective, but, you know, a couple places of women who are married to these kind of men and trying to hold it together and can't. And there's a lot of unhappiness there as well. I mean, there's a shocking scene early on where this boy who's kind of nerdy and I'm not really totally close friends with, but he comes to our house to kind of seek relief from his house where things are worse. And in one shocking moment in the book, this woman takes her life. And at the time, I had no way of understanding that, and I describe it kind of just as impressions and what I hear and how I'm afraid to see her corpse. But as I look back, there must have been a lot of women like that who were equally unhappy because they're misunderstood and they're trying to hold it together. And, you know, the whole liberation of women hasn't happened yet. So it's a bizarre world of incredible freedom and license, and yet at the same time kind of claustrophobia and people in chains, you know, mental chains and spiritual chains. And I think that's something I see as I look back. I mean, even my boyhood, I had total freedom in a way we'll never have again. You know, at 7 years old, you leave the house, you come home for lunch. Nobody asks where you've been or what you did. You're 8 years old. You come home and you hear the dinner bell, and if bad things happen, you don't tell anybody. Everything's kept in, you know, whether it's the suffering of the wives or the misery of the husband or what children are experiencing in terms of bullying or traumatic things. Everything's kept in a way that probably is shocking to people now.
And I think your ability to convey that was really maintaining that voice of the young John. And it allows you and him to explore. Sex was a big topic that, and your getting close and getting scared and just the way that boys talk amongst each other, and that was a kind of a thread running through your narrative. That's
a good point too. And as you look back, I mean, you know, there was no sex on TV or sex in the movies or sex in books. There was no internet. You know, I didn't even know that women had pubic hair until I was 12 or 13. I mean, that's kind of the way that world was. So even that, you're experiencing and finding it on your own in a way that is scary and exhilarating. I will say, you know, I have a daughter who's 14 now, and, you know, there's things I'm doing in that book when I'm 12 that is very different from the way things would unfold today, I think. But, yeah, the Catholic school girl and the public school girls, and then the fear and nervousness of this sexual world that I haven't had any way of kind of finding a way into understanding, I wanted to tell that too, but only through impressions, only through vignettes, without kind of ruining it all with some outside voice.
And you talk about the relationships with the neighborhood and school kids, and you brought up earlier Taddy Keegan was somebody who you were intrigued by. He let you do stuff with him, and yet he was kind of quirky and eccentric in a way. Versus the Creeleys, the Creeley brothers,
yeah.
who were mean, bullies.
I will say this, you know, as I look back, and first of all, you know, I couldn't have made Taddy Keegan up if I wanted to. He's such a a marvelous character, but I have a feeling things did not end well with him. And I've tried to find him a couple times. I can't track him down, but I just feel it didn't end well. But as I look back, he probably was touched in some way because he had a hard time emotionally connecting, and he would kind of look past you. He was very brave, very courageous, very exciting, reckless, and all that was appealing to me. But I'm sure there was something else in his mental makeup that was not quite there. But the interesting thing is, and this is, a lot of people have picked up on the bullying aspect of the book, which I never intended, and is only really in the first couple chapters. But the thing that is very, I think, interesting and profound to me is it's not all just about physical freedom. I mean, when Taddy Keegan comes along and the Creeleys have just been torturing me for a couple of years, it's not like in the movies where he stands up and protects me and there's a big fight and all of a sudden the Creeleys back. It wasn't like that at all. He just ignored them. And Taddy Keegan's effect on me was a mental liberation, kind of like William Blake says, we have these mind-forged manacles that we hold ourselves in by. And I just saw the way he ignored them, and he kind of mentally set me free until, you know, a key chapter early on, we go through this sewer tunnel, and I get out the other side, and all of a sudden the Creeleys hardly even exist for me anymore. And that was kind of the end of them. It was sort of mental liberation through this figure, this enigmatic, charismatic, bizarre, courageous, Irish, you know, lover of life figure, kind of, as I call him, kind of a Huck Finn character that enables all that to happen.
You just mentioned there's a scene or a passage in the book where you and Taddy are going through, I guess, like a pipe, a drain, a sewer pipe or something under.
Yeah, it's about 8 feet high.
Under the road. That, to me, represented a bit, not only a physical passage, but a big passage for you in that stage of your life, really.
Yeah, and that's one of those things, Suzanne, where I just did a little piece for a book page. It's a little electronic and physical journal that goes out to actually, it's not little. They have about 400,000 people that subscribe to it. And it was about reflecting on boyhood and the myth of the self. And this connects to your question here, how things like going through that sewer tunnel with Taddy Keegan is so huge for my liberation and so profound as a turning point early on. But you can see it in such mythical terms, too. I mean, but I didn't see that at the time, you know, the dark tunnel and making your way through and the other side and coming to the light and then feeling liberated. And, you know, that's a universal mythical kind of story, as is The Hill. You know, how many stories and movies and epics? So it is really interesting how these personal physical places or personal physical adventures connect kind of unconsciously on my part initially to these wider universal myths. And I think that that's fascinating how that happens even when we don't intend it.
Well, and I think that's why it's such a good read too. Also, you talk about priests. Priests were present, and you, as a young boy, seemed to have certain observations about them, but never really gave them much spiritual credence or maybe even authority.
Yeah. Again, I was trying to not look back and not look with judgment, just try and go back to how they appeared to me then. And, yeah, Catholicism, as is East Coast culture and Irish middle-class culture, runs heavy through here. I do remember early on working with my editor, he said, and to kind of tie things together here, he said, how come your father doesn't figure earlier in the book more, and how come Catholicism doesn't figure earlier in the book? And it's because when you're 7, 8, and 9, you don't see it that way. You know, father is just more of a distant presence, and Catholicism is just part of your world. But then you get to be 11, 12, and suddenly you're aware of these things. And so once you hit the midpoint of the book, Catholic culture plays a big role. And personally, you know, I had 3 or 4 cousins who were nuns, and my mother's brother was a famous Jesuit priest who went over to Japan with MacArthur and helped founded Sophia University in Tokyo, and he was their first dean. And I was named, my middle name, Coleman, after Father Coleman Daly, who was in charge of all the Jesuit missions all over the world. And my father was friends with this Bishop Wright, and we had priest at dinner on Sunday. And so it was just really intensely part of our life. But me as a boy seeing all that, I didn't necessarily see it the way I was supposed to. And a lot of these characters are sad or lost or corrupted somehow. So there is a lot of negative images, but I will say that when you get to chapter 10, there's an aunt in there, Sister Emmanuel, who's my father's younger sister.
Aunt Patsy.
And I think that redeems the book because, to me, she truly was saint-like, and I always knew that. And she is an amazing kind of transcendent figure in the book.
And that, your Aunt Patsy.
Yes.
There was a scene in the book where you go to visit her, and I felt like she had a knowledge and that you knew she had a knowledge about you, and that somehow in that scene you had to leave. Your father says it's time to go. And I don't know. I was left feeling that if only you could stay with her, she might be able to give you something that he couldn't.
Absolutely. Well, she understood my questions without me asking them. And she truly, I mean, she had this intestinal problem her whole life where she basically had no intestines and she was in terrible pain. And people came from, and I'm not exaggerating, Ohio and Virginia to visit her because she lived on two crackers a day. And she was, you know, 68 pounds and she was just amazing to look at, this beautiful face that never aged. And she never went anywhere, but she knew about all human experience. She understood every type of human being. And this is particularly at the time of the riots going on, you know, and I'm in a white suburb south of Pittsburgh, and Sister Emmanuel's in this hospital college. It's called Mercy College. Now it's called a Carlo College. And it's right next to the area where a lot of the riots were taking place, a very poor district in Pittsburgh near Oakland. And I've just had an incident prior to going to see her that very morning where I was staring at some African-American kids, and they mistook how I was staring at them, and I didn't understand them, and I had no way of knowing, but I'm fascinated by it, and I'm very much aware of the racial strife that's going on. And it ends up being a really uncomfortable scene where they start throwing rocks at me, and you know, I get to her, and I know she can explain it. I know she can make sense of it, and in my mind, I'm sort of mixing it up with Jesus and Christianity and turning stones into loaves of bread, and the whole thing kind of flows together in a way that I tried to get the confusion of my consciousness there. But I know if I could just talk to her, she could give me a way of understanding. In that same chapter, then, when I come home, my fascination continues with this African-American cleaning lady that we had had. And almost every other house in the neighborhood had white cleaning ladies, but we had this character named Lorraine, and my God, she had a hard life. And you know, I could feel the triggering inside me of this fascination with her and wanting to get to know her, but having no way of knowing her. And my mother, just so kind with Lorraine. And there's a key scene in the book where my mother drives her home because it's snowing out and the riots are literally going on. They're throwing stones at buses and buses are refusing to go into the neighborhood. And nothing's going to stop my mother from driving Lorraine home in the midst of all this.
I'm talking with John C. Hampsey about his memoir, Kaufman's Hill. And that whole thread of what was going on racially, certently in Pittsburgh and in many cities in the 60s, and through the lens of a small boy that knew something was up, but it wasn't something that was talked about in real straightforward terms for you, and you were left to make these observations of Lorraine and your mother's treatment of her versus your father and your uncle, who maybe were a little bit more racist in their conversations.
Yeah, they were. They were. I don't think they understood their positions, but of course they were. And the riots, you know, freaked them all out and how far this was going to go. And my mother was kind of apolitical. All she knew is that she wanted to make sure Lorraine was okay. And Lorraine had 7 or 8 kids, and one of her kids had 14 children, and they were all poor and all struggling. And that's my mother's reactive from that point of view. And I'm kind of caught in between all that. But I truly remember becoming fascinated about who she was, and I wanted to go to her house, and I wanted to know what it was like to be, you know, the term we used then was Negro. But I had no way of understanding that. Other than to see her really on kind of, again, mythical level to me, you know.
Well, I wonder if you are going to continue the story.
I don't know. That's a good question. I think, let me just say 2 things about that. when I wrote this, more than anything, I wanted to capture the early mid-60s. That was my goal, and then put my story inside it. I don't want to just write a memoir because, like a lot of people do, I just want to tell the story of my life. That's not going to work. So I don't know if I'll have that kind of hook again where there's something I want to go after, and I have to use my story to get there. So I could never do this again, I'll tell you that. I mean, it's almost, once you go back, well, I'm sure you've experienced this. When you tell a story, say to family and friends over and over and over again, and it's a story about something that happened to you when you were a child or an adolescent, you can't really go back and remember that story again. All you have is the way you wrote it, and everything else is kind of gone. And it's as I enter childhood to tell all these stories, it's like I can't go back again now because all I have is the way I've written it. And so there is a kind of sacrificing of memory in the process of turning it into memoir. And I'm willing, you know, I'd love to do that again if I can find a way to justify it, to make it work.
Just before we say goodbye today, I do want to ask you about your previous work, Paranoia and Contentment. Just the title right there is intriguing to me, and maybe you could share with me and our listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, that book came out in 2004 for hardback, so about 10 years ago. And it's the first book to look at paranoia in a positive light. And what I stumbled upon, the way the book kind of came into being, is I realized, I teach classical literature and romantic literature, so I do a lot with the Greeks, and I realized paranoia, of course, a Greek word. Para means beside, and noia means mind. So if you're paranoid, you're thinking beside the mind, you're off track, you're not normal. We have to fix the situation so you're normal. And that all follows after Plato. Plato turns it into a negative term. But before Plato, to be paranoid was a positive term. It meant you were going off track, but in a visionary, creative, often dangerous way. And what I realize is all the people who've changed Western culture were off track in that visionary, dangerous, creative way, whether it's Socrates or Jesus or Virginia Woolf or Nietzsche or Emily Dickinson or Kierkegaard. And these are all the people that I then look at, these people that had this creative, dangerous, visionary, off-track thinking. And in that way, paranoia becomes a positive term, and I coin a term for that. I call that the paranoiac when it's used in that visionary way versus paranoidic, when it's negative and fears and delusions that somebody's coming to take away your contentment. I made sure it was reader-friendly, so there's not a lot of footnotes, and it is a hybrid. I'm so happy that Virginia Press published it as it was, because there's a mixture of, you know, analytical writing, critical thinking, but there's also pieces that are meditative essay and fantasy and even some fiction in places. I bring myself into it, into this kind of rethinking of Western culture. And that's why they made me call it a personal essay in Western thought. So it's written in a kind of hybrid, quirky, personal essay form, even though it covers everything from the Greeks to contemporary America in just 200 pages.
And that's what, to me, makes it sound like a fun read, in that not overly academic, but bringing in a lot of our culture. And our past.
I will say, as a way to kind of unite this, if you don't mind, I did my the book's been out a couple weeks, and Coffman's Hill I'm talking about, and I've heard from a lot of people just in the last couple weeks, and they're all saying some things similar to you, that, you know, I'm thinking about my childhood differently now, or I'm seeing things I didn't see before. When I did the reading at Cal Poly 2 weeks ago, and there was a couple hundred people in the room, and all the questions and answers afterwards kind of gravitated to, you know, after hearing that, I'm seeing my own childhood differently. But there was a student there. He was a student of mine a while ago. Now he teaches. He's probably in his mid-30s. And he actually made a connection between paranoia and contentment in Coffin's Hill that I thought was really interesting. I never saw. And that is that this kind of creative, dangerous, visionary thinking, the paranoiac, is kind of what we have when we're young boys and young girls. And that's kind of what plays out in Coffin's Hill, is this conflict between kind of thinking off track and free that's creative and dangerous, visionary even, as opposed to being drawn into a world where, you know, going that way is seen as not normal. And so there is a connection I never saw, I think, between the two books.
Well, I think it always takes the readers to make those connections. And so we could possibly connect to what you're working on now.
And it's another kind of hybrid book. It's called Soda Lake, and I don't know if any of the listeners out there know, in the Central Valley out here, we have this huge, in the Carrizo Plains, this huge lake of dried up salt. It's actually, when you go to see it, you feel like you're on Mars. It's just 20 miles long and a couple miles wide, and you can walk across it. It's just all encrusted salt, but you kind of sink in the further you go into the salt. So there's a kind of disappearance of a person into that lake at the beginning, and then the book kind of unfolds as a sort of existential mystery based on that opening scene. But there's also autobiography in it, and I'm in the book as a narrator and as an author, and my real self is in it, and I'm trying to stitch things together. There's also some imaginary portraits of potential persons coming out of my life, and then there's also this mystery that unfolds that takes me to Ireland and Donegal trying to find a character named McQuaid who's not real, and he connects to another person who connects to another person, and so the book is kind of an expanding mix of autobiography and existential mystery. I'm not really sure how it's going to quite end, but I'm about two-thirds of the way through. And one of the early chapters just got published in the Alaska Quarterly, so at least somebody's picking up on it in a positive way.
Well, very good. We'll look forward to that, and I hope that you make it up here to Sonoma County sometime soon. John C. Hamsey, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Suzanne, your questions were marvelous. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
John C. Hamsey. The book is Kaufman's Hill, a memoir. Let's take a short break and listen to another man's expression of growing up. When we come back, I'll speak with Michael Nagler. But now here's John Gorka from his album, So Dark You See. Stay with us.
Yes, and lesser poverties. I was born to privilege that I did not see. Like a pigment in my skin, one of free and easy. I didn't know it, but my way was paved. I grew up a Catholic boy in a northeastern state, a place when asked where you from, some people tend to hesitate, reply a little bit late, as if maybe you didn't rate. I was born to ignorance and privilege. My dad ran a printing press, a tag and label factory. May have seen it as a child, now a distant memory, almost too faint to see. Dark red brick factory, didn't know it, but my way was paved. We moved from a city street shortly after I arrived to a house on a gravel road where I learned to be alive. I'll walk, run, and ride. That's where I learned to come alive. Didn't know it, but my way was paved. If the wind is at your back and you never turn around, you may never know the wind is there. You may never hear the sound. Oh. Got to grow and go to school, work at home and dream at night, even be a college fool like I had any right. Never went through a war, never Great Depression poor. Didn't know it, but my way was paved. Nose to the grindstone, shoulder to the wheel, back against the wall, maybe you know how it feels.
Ignorance and Privilege from John Gorka.
You're listening to A Novel Idea, and I'm Suzanne Lang.
Michael Nagler is Professor Emeritus of Classics and Comparative Literature at UC Berkeley, where he co-founded the Peace and Conflict Studies Program. He is the author of The Search for a Nonviolent Future, among other works, and is the founder of the Meta Center for Nonviolence Education.
Michael Nagler, welcome.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Some of our listeners might not be familiar with you or your work, so I think I want to maybe allow you to give us a brief introduction, because you have a very deep history with and maybe have spent a good part of your life's work on nonviolence and the study of nonviolence. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your past?
Yes. Well, I always had an inclination toward nonviolence. And then when I was about to become a professor at Berkeley way back in 1966, I met a meditation teacher from India whom I spent the next nearly 40 years with. And he had met Gandhi and been deeply impressed by that meeting. So I kind of caught fire from Sri Ishwaran of the Blue Mountain Center of Meditation. And I noted that he had a number of passionate projects that he wanted to get done. And one of them was about nonviolence, and particularly the spiritual depth of nonviolence as Gandhi reached and interpreted it. And so that became my passion. And I remember one very quiet occasion, Ishwaran, I think, was just walking past me, and he quietly said, but it sure landed in my heart, he said, "That man, Gandhi, came back from South Africa having realized God and set about solving every problem in the modern world." So I said, "Wow," silently. I was by then a professor at Berkeley, and so I spent a lot of time working nonviolence and Gandhi into the program there. I felt it was a huge omission that he was not covered in any course, except maybe a little bit of colonial history. So with some colleagues in the late 70s, we founded a program called Peace and Conflict Studies, and I taught a course on Gandhi and nonviolence that eventually became a year-long course. And the last time I taught it, it was webcast, I'm happy to say. So I was also founding at the same time a nonprofit called the Meta Center, M-E-T-T-A, and that is now based in Petaluma. And on our website, which is metacenter.org, you will find this whole entire course. So people paid thousands of dollars of tuition for this thing, and you can have it free. And in the meantime, I'm involved with a lot of organizations, and META has close collaborators with, for example, Nonviolent Peace Force, and we're always talking to Fellowship of Reconciliation. And we have a very rich website, and I have two books out, and as you know, Suzanne, we also do a radio program every other week at KWMR in Point Reyes called Peace Paradigm Radio. And that is a lot of fun. So we're colleagues in that way.
So that's Peace Paradigm Radio. I would like for you to describe for our listeners who may not be familiar with the whole concept of satyagraha. Mm-hmm.
Satyagraha literally means clinging to truth. It was a term that Gandhi invented in South Africa because he found that the term that people were applying to what he was doing, namely passive resistance, was very misleading. There was absolutely nothing passive about his type of resistance. And it wasn't limited to resistance. It would be entering into conversation with someone whose program or whose behavior you find unacceptable. And if you're able to persuade them of the wrongness of their ways, there's nothing to resist. Satyagraha worked very well for him because the term sat, which is the root of the word truth in Sanskrit, actually has three dimensions. It means true as opposed to false. It means reality as opposed to unreality. And it means the good as opposed to the bad. So all of those three are wrapped up in one very inspiring vision. And so he worked on developing this science for nigh on to 50 years. He's by far not the only person to be a powerful leader and a pioneer in the field of nonviolence or satyagraha, but he's the only one that had a lifetime to devote to developing it as a science.
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
A science.
Meaning that what you're dealing with, Suzanne, is a force, not an idea. There is an idea about nonviolence, but nonviolence itself is a force of nature. And he often compared it to gravity or electricity, which are powerful forces, which can be either constructive or destructive. And when we learn how to use them, they can do incredible things. And recently, of course, long after Gandhi's assassination, we learned that there are in the central nervous system of human beings these special neurons called mirror neurons, so that, for example, let's say you're threatening me and you want me to do something, and I respond with neither anger nor fear. I say to you very calmly, I will not comply, but I do not disrespect you as a human being. Let's get into this. And think of that case recently that happened in Decatur, Georgia, where this deranged young man walked into a school with 800 students, loaded with weapons, off his meds, schizophrenic. And this one woman who just happened to be in the office that day, Antoinette Hill, steps down from her desk and walks over to him and says, you have problems, honey. I'm sorry. I have problems, too. And, you know, I love you. I'm sure this will all work out. Basically, she talked him out of it. So he's coming at her with threat. And she, although she's scared inside, let's not fool ourselves, she's plenty scared, she decides not to act out of that fear. What happens then, this is really almost a miracle, that fear energy rolls over and gets converted into a creative force. And we know from science, from neuroscience, that that force immediately registers in the brain of that young man. Now, that's not the whole story. You know, you can still override what's going on in your brain. But at least this shows that there's even a physiological dimension which can be measured and published about. And, you know, there's a book called Mirror Neurons. It's called Mirroring People by Mario Iacoboni. Yeah.
I wonder sometimes if we are, as a species, losing our ability to be compassionate. We, as a species, have so much electronic input of information and visuals, and there's been some episodes of road rage lately that have been in the news. We have the police violence that we've been seeing all over the country, along with the militarization of the police. We have the political incivility going on in Washington, and then at this other pinnacle, we have snuff films being put out there by ISIS, along with the murders and terrorism that they're inflicting on people as well. And how do we as individuals face these realities, and how do we approach even breaking them down from the interpersonal, that might be road rage, to this kind of global terrorism we're seeing?
That is the key question, no question about it. And at the Meta Center, we've developed a tool called Roadmap, which is a conceptual scheme that you can see on our website, that at the core, at the center, it addresses exactly what you were just raising. What can we do as individuals? And we have five suggestions that we list off. And the very first one is to break contact with that conditioning that you were just describing. We're increasing violence by every means possible. I won't say deliberately, but systematically conditioning ourselves to bring out the worst aspects of our nature.
Is it a carelessness?
Wow, is it a carelessness? It's certainly a kind of ignorance, and I guess you could call it carelessness of an extreme sort. It arises from a false image of who we are. And that false image has been part of our culture for about 300 years, maybe a little less. We're a much higher image of who we are, that as mind, body, and spirit, capable of empathy and creative action, has really been around for much, much longer, although it's been temporarily obscured by the culture of industrial civilizations. So at the Meta Center, we work with the details, you know, the laws of nonviolence, how to do it correctly, but we also work on trying to change the culture.
Because it does seem that fear is at the core of all violence, and we perpetrate fear almost at every level. One could say that the minimum wage, for instance, or if you're working for minimum wage, that you're actually living in fear on a day-to-day basis. And so how can then we even break through that? It seems like you're presenting tools, very elemental tools, but it requires a degree of paying attention, doesn't it?
It requires attention, for sure. It requires a deliberate withdrawal of our attention from the false world that's been created by advertising and the way mainstream news is presented and so forth, and putting our attention on the positive capabilities of human nature and of our own nature. So in that list, the first thing we suggest is dump your TV. You know, watch as little of that as you can.
But not your radio?
Not local radio, by all means. Of course not. But what we say is, you know, when you really break contact with the mass media, you are, in a sense, opening up a vacuum in your mind. And then what are you going to do? We recommend you fill that vacuum by learning everything you can about nonviolence. And nonviolence is not just a set of techniques. It's that different image of the human being that we were alluding to earlier. And we also recommend that for those of you who feel inclined to do so, get a spiritual practice, you know, if you don't already have one. But, you know, explore some valid system of meditation that works for you. And then we recommend being much more personal in your interactions with others, because part of this false image involves a dehumanization and a walling off of ourselves from one another. So in all your interactions with you and the meter maid or whoever, just try to be more personal. And then finally, get involved in a project that suits your passions and your capabilities. And by all means, use that as an occasion to describe what we're calling the new story or the higher image of the human being.
Now, I want to talk about your books in just a minute. I just want to pursue another question about world peace, about the, or even local peace, neighborhood peace. We live in a world of mammon. We live in a world of money. And I wonder, is there an economics to peace? War, terrorism, the militarization of the police force, that's part of an industry, and people are making money.
Yeah.
And that is how we have created our system of exchange and even of expression and value. And so I wonder if there is an economics to peace that is viable, that is achievable?
The answer, I think, is a resounding yes. It's not going to be simple, but you may be aware that one of the things that Gandhi was passionately interested in was economics. He didn't know anything about the field, he was proud to say. He'd never read an economic textbook, but he doped out a complete economic system that would be compatible with and derived from the principles of nonviolence, just as our present system derives from the concept of a materialistic, selfish person. So, for example, he introduced this idea, which he learned from English law, actually, of trusteeship as a substitute for ownership. So that instead of me saying, you know, I came here in my car, I came here in the car that I'm using as a tool to do my work. And the minute I don't need that tool anymore, I will not regard myself as having a relationship with it. And if you could inculcate that spirit of trusteeship, you in that one move, you would change to a different economic system.
And our current economic system is part of what creates this fear that then perpetrates violence. And if we get back to the physiological, that we're living in that state of fear then.
Yeah.
But if we could alleviate that financial insecurity by moving towards this trusteeship, it could change the way we actually relate to the world.
It would also be enormously helpful to recognize that we've reached the limit of what can make us happy in terms of external consumption and possessions. And, you know, they have graphs. Economics shows you graphs that will show you that when your wealth goes up beyond a certain point, it levels off. Your happiness does not increase with that wealth. And if you're a Koch brother, it actually starts to decrease. So being in contact with what makes us actually fulfilled and secure would be a tremendous help. So if we could find a way to touch that much deeper spirituality within us, we would liberate ourselves from the need to consume, which would take tremendous pressure off the planet and would take tremendous degree of competition out of the international arena.
And you have created some tools to help us through the publication of your books. And so let's talk about your books, The Search for a Nonviolent Future and your most recently released book, The Nonviolence Handbook, A Guide for Practical Action.
Yeah, thank you, Suzanne. Yeah, Search is kind of like a lifetime work, a magnum opus. It really takes an overview of the entire field. And if you wanted to sit back and have an inspiring read, there's probably about 100 stories in that book. Stories of actually regimes that were nonviolent from the top. There are two of them that I know of. The Holy Experiment that took place in what is now Pennsylvania over a period of 75 years just before the revolution. And in India, the empire that was run by Emperor Ashoka in the 3rd century of our era was run by decree as a nonviolent regime. So there's even that kind of story. But what I try to do is tease out from these inspiring events what made them work and how you as individuals can use them before even we get to thinking about how to organize them and what to go against. Now, the newer book, which is a much shorter one, The Nonviolence Handbook, was like a condensation of everything that was covered in Search. And the handbook is basically for an audience within an audience. The core audience is the activist. I say we because I work closely with colleagues at the Meta Center in everything I do. We were eager to learn from the lessons of Occupy. We ended up thinking that Occupy, brilliant, beautiful thing that it was, has started at the wrong end of the stick. They started with protest when they were in fact much weaker than the opponent they were protesting. What they should have done is start with individual empowerment, go on from there to what Gandhi called constructive program, and go on from there to do protest where you had to from a position of strength. So we wanted to put this thing in the hands of someone who was going to be involved in a nonviolent action of some kind in order to do it, and this is kind of our mantra these days, in order to carry out nonviolence more safely and more effectively. And it's incidentally, it's also now an audiobook. So if people were to subscribe to audible.com with this book, then Meta Center gets a bonus from that.
And do you recommend Even a book group take this on?
Oh, I would strongly recommend that. It's been known to happen. There are book groups. I know of one down in Palo Alto and a few others around the world. Incidentally, both these books have gone into translation in other languages. In Search for Nonviolent Future has actually, we're almost finished with a translation into Farsi, which is the language spoken in Iran and around parts of Afghanistan. So, yeah, I think it's great for book groups, and there's a study guide to the book on our website. So,
thank you, Michael Nagler.
Thank you, Suzanne.
My conversation with Michael Nagler. Earlier in the broadcast, we heard from John C. Hamsey. A Novel Idea is a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Public Media. We have production assistance from Sean Knight, Wendy Nicholson, and Mary Moore Campagna. Listen to us online and subscribe to our podcasts at krcb.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a Novel Idea. Thank you.